You, we were discussing before when I was here last, and I could not remember. I know it wasn't that long ago. So much has transpired. I've moved since then. In fact, I moved just this weekend. My entire house and all of its contents. We lived at a rather nice round number, 234 Basswood Drive. We had to pick all the stuff up, pack it up, and move to 238 Basswood Drive. Needless to say, no U-Hauls were required. But it did instead mean still that all of our stuff had to be packed up into boxes, and it's always a frightening experience to see what's under the bed and what's collected there in only a matter of a month or two. And unfortunately, to have college students come over and help you, which I was able to get a few, and realize that all of your life is being exposed. The students will now be sitting in your classroom, hobnobbing with other students. A little disconcerting, to say the least. And I asked them to please not mention or pay attention to anything, just to do their job quietly. It's good, faithful servants of Christ. And they did, I have to say, they were a good group. So I've been a little out of it, trying to get myself back into my rhythm come Monday, which hopefully will happen, or else my students will suffer. Either way, it's nice to be back again. Since I was here with you, I think I was up at White Lake once and got to see, maybe some of you were there, and I apologize if probably, I think I saw some of you and said hi, and things flying out of my mind too quickly, but it was nice to see you up there as well. I worked this morning out of Titus chapter 2. Pastor John said that he's going to finish up Genesis and would like to do that, so he left it open for me, which is always a bit of a difficult task because the whole scriptures are open to you, and you tend to preach your hobby horses, something that's bothered you or something that's hit you during the week, and so you tend to chase this around, these little spiritual tangents, and then sort of unleash them on whatever church you end up behind the pulpit of. So, attempt not to do this. I had heard a sermon preached a while back on Titus chapter 2, and the sermon went one way, but as I heard the sermon, something struck me, and of course, as per usual, my little phone came out with my little stylus, and I was immediately typing away some notes, and I missed the end of the sermon, which I don't advise any of you to do. It was bad of me to do it. I missed some really good stuff. Don't do that. But while I was doing it, a couple of things jumped out of this text at me, and I've really been mulling them over for the last couple of weeks, because things I had not thought of, in a way maybe I hadn't thought of it. And one of those things that caught me is the idea of beauty. And I think you'll see it come out of the text that Paul deals with here, or gives us in Titus chapter 2. Beauty is a really strange thing, and as I think about it, and I think about my Christian life, I wouldn't categorize it as beautiful. I really wouldn't use that term. I would think of rigorous. I would think of upright. I would think of righteous. Well, I mean, not that my Christian life has been these things, but it's certainly meant to imitate them, or approximate these things, to approximate righteousness and upstandingness, to be good and to be wholesome. I think of all of the things my father is. He's an upright and righteous, upstanding man. Beautiful, however, is a different term. Something about beauty that it's hard to get your fingers on. And it means more than just good. It means more than just upright. It means more than designed well. I'm an aviator. I love flying. My passion is airplanes. And I was trying to tell my students the other day, when we were looking at aesthetics, what beauty is. And, of course, for me, I put a slide up of a World War II fighter. An F-4 U-4 Corsair, 1942, 1943. I am enamored by the Corsair. The first time I saw one at an air show, I almost cried. I actually did cry. I just don't want to say that I did, so I say I almost cried. I almost wept openly. The lines of the plane are so gorgeous. The bent gull wing, the lines of the fuselage, it's just perfect. Everything is so proportionate, so gorgeous. The paint job was perfect. And I showed this to the students, and I don't know why I thought that they would go along with me. When I said, this is beautiful, I got a lot of strange looks. Crooked eyebrows and, you know, sneers. But to me, that's beautiful. And why is it beautiful? There's something about it I can't say. There's something about the line, something about the balance. It's almost hard to express, really. See, there's a lot of planes that'll fly. But when it's a beautiful one, the lines are just perfect. The balance, there's something extra in it. It's complete. And in fact, the prettier it is, the better it does. This is one of those strange God things in his own creation. The more beautiful they are, tend to be, the better they perform. Function actually follows form. It's a reversal of the old American pragmatic version. For some reason, God makes things beautiful, and they work better when they're beautiful. And beauty is a fantastic thing. It grips us in the heart, but it also grips us everywhere. A plane that's beautiful not only flies wonderfully, it looks beautiful. It's just got the whole package. And it's indescribable what that thing is. We try to talk about it. Beauty is balance. In fact, we don't know what to call it, so we say beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We don't even know what it is. All we know is it's there, and you'll know it when you see it. When you see a beautiful sunset, all these typical postcard beautiful things, you know it. You're struck by it. You're overwhelmed by it. And you look at it and you go, there's sunsets, but that's the perfect sunset. All of them are sunsets. The sun goes down every time. But for some reason on that one, it's got it all. It's got the complete package. That's what makes it beautiful. It comes with a power when it's pretty. And there's something about that. There's something about what's beautiful in God. If we think about God, I wonder how many of us use that adjective. For me, growing up, God was always a truant officer in the sky with one of those, what's the Board of Educations? I used to have one. My middle school teacher had one hanging in his principal house. Board of Education, you know, and had a hole in the back of it. And I saw it used. Never used on me. I saw it used. Can't do that anymore, obviously, but it was used. That's how I thought of God. He's got his Board of Education up there, and he's whacking the back of his knuckles, and he's waiting for me to do something wrong. This is my God. He's righteous. He's holy. He's up there. He's distant. But how often do we think of the word beautiful to describe our God? I want to challenge us, and I think Paul is trying to challenge Titus, stuck in Crete, to rethink of who God is as he's living in a very defiled time. And there's good analogies between what Paul is doing in Titus, talking about Crete, and what we're doing in America in the year 2001. Crete was a difficult place. In fact, Paul will actually quote from the old philosophical phrase, and you can see this if you're willing on chapter 1, verse 12. One of themselves, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars." We could say something the same about maybe our politicians. I don't know if we'd say all Americans, but certainly many of Americans and many of Western world falls into this category. All Cretans are liars. This was a philosophical puzzle in the ancient Greek world. Imagine a Cretan coming up to you and saying, "All Cretans are liars." Where do you go from there? If you're always a liar, that statement's not true, and it means you're not a liar. If you aren't a liar, then that statement is a liar, in case you are a liar. Anyway, I won't do philosophy 101, but that's a neat little place to start. This is where Paul finds himself in Titus. And he's talking to Titus, who's stuck on Crete with this really profligate, really bad society that they're living in. And there's a problem he's encountering in that apparently the church is starting to look a lot like its surroundings. Isn't this always the case? We tend to absorb our culture and then share it back out again. And it seems by the time Paul is writing this that the church he left in Crete is starting to look Cretan. And this is not a good thing. Crete is a terrible place. In fact, Crete is so bad, has been so bad for so long, that it has a reputation. A reputation is a dangerous thing. Once you have a reputation, you're never trusted. Once someone thinks of you as a liar, you're always a liar. You can fight for the rest of your life to try to overcome it. The best thing to do is move. Leave entirely. Go somewhere where no one knows you and start from scratch. Because once the reputation settles in, there's no way of getting around it. Once you've lied, a liar once a liar, always a liar, once a cheater, always a cheater. We've heard these things before. And apparently, in Paul's time, this is just as true. The Cretans had a bad reputation. And now they're trying to bring the gospel to this culture in Crete and get them to change. So they're having to leave their reputation. What a difficult task. You've got to recreate yourself. Reinvent yourself. I'm no longer a Cretan, I'm a Christian. CR is the same, everything else is different. Everything about the way I live and the way I speak is different. To come out of the world and be separate from it. What a difficult task. And here in Crete, maybe even more difficult. And we'll find that Paul is really upset and really nervous about this reputation problem. You're going to have to establish a whole new set of reputations, a whole new set of personal histories that distinguishes you from this Cretan world. Titus has a lot on his plate. What a church to have to pastor. What a community to have to pastor in. And so in chapter 2, by the time we get here, Paul has set the stage for the bit of advice now he is going to level to Titus. And living in an age that is profligate. I was talking to some friends about some movies the other night. I always use that as sort of a cultural tie. How many movies I've seen are actually rated R, and I almost don't even know it. In fact, most TV today, 10 years ago, would have been considered rated R. And yet our language, the way we dress, the way we talk, we're all starting to absorb somehow this culture around us. We're all starting to look like Cretans. And so Paul has something to say to us as we live in a very Cretan culture. So let's look at chapter 2 of Titus and see how Paul directs Titus to live in this world. And there's a couple key things I want us to note about how he's going to do this. And the central place in all of this is going to be the place of doctrine. Ooh, doctrine. You can put a college class to sleep. You can't put a college class to sleep faster than saying the word doctrine when you walk into the classroom. Out like light. But Paul is not talking about doctrine the way we think of it. He's talking about a full and complete view of doctrine as a way of life, as an individual way, as a unique way of life that separates us. And I think he's going to give us some clues here that help us in this endeavor. Let's look at Titus chapter 1 and verse 1. But as for you, now this is, again, all these comparisons Paul is drawing out is constantly against this Cretan culture. So imagine everything about Crete, but as for you, this is entirely opposite. Speak things. Now, in this culture, in this day and age, words are of very little value. The spoken word is sort of lost an awful lot. The English language is falling off steeply. I notice in my classes all the time that I don't use the hip ebonics that are going around, and I'm always slightly out of the loop. And they're always throwing words at me I don't understand. We've lost something. There's nothing historical about our language. There's nothing rich about it. We're starting to lose it. But speaking is very important. The words you use and how you use them. God chose to reveal himself to us through, as boring as it is, black print on white paper. This is not dynamic. This is not exciting. This is not a PowerPoint. This is not a video clip. You have to read this. You have to sit down and pick through the words and actually read it. It's a boring, boring process. But this is how God communicates. And so, to a culture that's not used to reading, to a culture that's not used to his word, he doesn't say do anything different. Speak. Go back to the word. Use the word. That's God's chief motive. Whether you think it works or not, it's God's chief method. So he gives us first thing is to speak. Use words. Use words well. Use words properly. Speak of Scripture. Speak the way God has taught us to speak. It's not that all these other methods aren't helpful, but God has established a method that always works. God's word does not return void. His PowerPoint might. His word, however, does not. There's something about his word that carries, and so we're called to speak, whether the culture wants to hear it or not. We speak the things which are fitting of sound or fitted for sound doctrine. Sound is a wonderful word. The doctrine we're supposed to speak to people is not just any doctrine, and it's not doctrine that's just true. There's a lot of truth in this world. There's a lot of truth that relates to a lot of things, but there's very few things that are sound. What's the difference between true and sound? True is anything that's related to reality. That's fine. There's advice that works out there all the time. There are a lot of non-Christians that are very happy. In fact, there are more non-Christians that are happy than there are Christians that are happy. That may be more our problem than theirs. So there's a lot of truth that works, and even the demons know the truth, but it's different between true and sound doctrine. What does it mean to be sound? I'm going to carry the aviation analogy through just for a minute. Soundness means that it's constructed properly. Right? What's the job of an airplane? The job of an airplane is not to kill the passengers. That's the job. Transportation is secondary. First thing is not to die. Wouldn't be good if you got somewhere and you ended up in pieces. So you want to get there alive. That's the first job. So the plane is designed this way. It's designed, but if you really wanted to design a truly safe airplane, you would basically make a box of solid steel and stick you in it. You are safe. Job number one done. That's true. But a sound airplane has to do its job well. It's got to be designed perfect. In fact, the design has to enhance its own capabilities. Think of a car that's designed well, a sound car. Sound car drives well, handles well. All cars handle, but a sound car handles well. It's smooth, it's good on gas, it's strong, it's fast. It's got the whole package. It's a beautiful arrangement. Doctrine we're talking about is not just truth. There's a lot of that. But we speak the truth in love. Because doctrine that's sound enhances its own truth. It enhances the life of those who hold it. Sound doctrine is a full life of beauty. It's a full life of perfection. It's not just arid doctrines. It's not just truths. It's not just logical propositions we toss out. Doctrine tends to take on this. There's a lot of truth in doctrine. A lot of it isn't very sound, though. It's very true. You put it up against any logical logician, any logical phrase, any logical calculus, it works out just fine. But the doctrine we're talking about is sound. It makes life work. It makes life smooth. It makes it fly and handle nicely. So soundness is a beautiful, full-orbed word. Doctrine, the law, is not meant to just be logic. It's meant to be life. It's meant to be lived. It's meant to be enjoyed. It's a fullness. It's a sound doctrine. The design is so perfect, it enhances life. It enhances the doctrine we believe. And so this is what we're called to take out. It's a big task. Because it's easy if God just called us to speak truth. That's easy. Anybody can speak truth. Our media is full of people who love to speak truth. To live it entirely different. We can speak it all day long. Can we actually speak it and then live it? We've got to speak this sound doctrine, but it's got to be sound. And so we're called to live a full life of doctrine. And then in verse 2, Paul is going to break out what this means. And the thing that's really helpful of Paul here, when he's talking about sound doctrine, is he lays it out very carefully by people group. He doesn't say something benign, be nice, be good. He lays it out. Here you are. Older men, do this. Older women, do this. Young women, do this. Young men, do that. Servants, do this. A couple things about this. One is, this is a very unpleasant several verses in a postmodern culture. It is very difficult in the postmodern culture to talk about inequality, to talk about differences, gender and age differences, that these people groups have different responsibilities, and that they're not all the same. It's a difficult doctrine in an age sort of bent on equality and egalitarianism. But Paul is not interested in speaking to the culture. He's not interested in bending the gospel. He's not interested in bending the doctrine, the sound doctrine, to make it pleasing to the culture. And this is something I always find interesting in myself. And someone said to me one day, Dan, why do you work so hard to defend God? Because when I argue, I'm always trying to say, no, that's not what God meant. You see, God's really... No, you see, when God judged, you know, the Canaanites, he was really good, but why defend him? God needs no defense. God is an unpleasant character. Christ is an unpleasant character. Even the disciples that knew Christ best were offended by him. God is not easy. He's not nice. He's not easy to get along with. He's not comfortable. In fact, the beginning of wisdom is fear. God is righteous and God is holy. And God's gospel and his doctrine aren't always easy to swallow. But the fact, for some reason, that we want to make our gospel acceptable by our culture, we always water it down, we round off its edges, we make it smooth, we make it easy to digest, and then we throw it out there. As Bonhoeffer would say, a cheap discipleship we've tossed on our culture. And of course, we've sold God badly. Because God is not cheap, he's not easy, he's not comfortable. God is somewhat unsettling. And so in chapter 2 here, we get an unsettling bit of requirements. And so he deals with each of us differently. He deals with older men differently, with their responsibility, their job to lead and to guide. And notice the words around it: temperate, dignified, sensible. I love that word. Paul uses that over and over, sensible. Be smart. Be sensible. This is not a radical doctrine of obedience. Be sensible. Sound in faith and love and perseverance. And then the older women are entrusted to train up the younger women. I think the only group that he doesn't use sensible around are the older women. The old men are supposed to be sensible, the young men are supposed to be sensible, and the women. The old women are not. Now, you can take that in a lot of directions. I'm going to take it in this one, because I'd like to walk out of here. I'm going to say, because old women are already sensible. They don't have to be told. Golf clap. I've got a wife and two daughters, man. Older women don't have to be sensible, but they do have to train up. And by their actions, they are meant to be guides. And this is interesting in a postmodern culture, because the ideal individual in the postmodern culture these days is the adolescent male. I don't know why that is, but everyone wants to be adolescent, right? We've got to retain youth longer. In fact, we're not happy as older people unless we're doing what teenagers can do. Driving their cars and talking like them and living like them. That's the ideal, is to be young again. That's not the way God paints it. It's actually to be old. The older is to be wise. To be older has been to walk with Christ longer, to be mature. And as a matter of fact, if you're going to talk about emulation, it's the young called to emulate the old. To learn from them, to learn from their reverence, to learn from their discipline, to learn from their experiences. And so the older are set up as our true models. And that's a lot of responsibility. Because those who are in that position now are required to live righteously under the eye. Always being watched, always being studied. It's a heavy responsibility. And it's the right responsibility. Age is not something that's supposed to be denied. It's something that's supposed to be savored. It's something that's supposed to be respected. It's a place of great responsibility and great power. Our culture has denied that, unfortunately. And so the young women are supposed to look up to the older men, older women, and the young men are supposed to be looking up to the older men. And of course, these things about our family relationships do not jive well with our culture. But God has established our places in this society. And if we're going to believe what he says about soundness of doctrine, we have to believe that these points are not there to hurt us. They're not meant to limit us. They're not meant to hold us back. They're meant to give us a fullness of life. Christ came to give us a fullness of life. He gave us himself so that we might enjoy all things. And so we always have to read these verses after we read verse 1. This is part of sound living. This is full of a joy. This is part of a joyous life, are these responsibilities. And so women are supposed to, young women, sensible, pure, workers at home, kind, subject to their husbands, and men to be sensible also, because the young are rarely sensible. I am young enough still to be unsensible. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds, purity in doctrine, and dignified. And those things make a lot of sense. We can understand that. It's the next one that's even more difficult to swallow. In a politically democratic era, verse 9 forward is somewhat difficult. Urge bond slaves to be subject to their own masters and everything, to be well-pleasing, not argumentative, not pilfering, showing all good faith. Now, I heard the pastor, I heard her do this, sort of tried to ease this a little bit and make this a little more comfortable and say, maybe a good analogy is going to work. I don't know about that. I have a boss, and I don't think of myself as a bondservant. Maybe some days I do. Maybe Monday morning you think yourself as a bondservant. You have no choice but to be there at whatever time. But this is a little more rigorous than that. This is a little more difficult than that. No matter what your circumstance, you're not supposed to be looking out for your own justice. You're supposed to be looking out for the soundness of Christ's doctrine. Even to be a bondservant, to be the lowest of all positions in the worst of all places, even there is an opportunity to live up to the sound doctrines God has given us. Not pilfering, but showing all good faith. There is no high and low in God's economy. There is no better or worse. The bondslave can live up to the sound doctrines of Christ as well as the older elder in society can. And the justices of society oftentimes are for God to heal. And he does, thankfully. But our responsibility in our place, and I've noticed this, I've noticed this in this recent culture, that we hate being in a place of obedience. We hate listening to our elders. We hate owning up to our bosses. It's very uncomfortable to be told what to do and to do it. I want to be myself. I want to do what I want to do. That's Cretan. And Paul is saying, don't do what you want to do. Do what Christ has called you to do. One of my favorite cartoons, the old Far Side. Remember the old Far Side cartoons that would come out on the bottom? My favorite. I always have the old Far Side. And there's one where it's a bunch of penguins in this big ice float. And you're all looking at them. And the little one, you know, the little one in the middle, his eyes get big and he goes, I just got to be me, darn it. I just got to be me. And that really is the claim of the age, right? To be myself. To choose things that appeal to me. To have a life I agree with. I was talking to a professor of mine, and we were talking about that very point. I may have mentioned this already. I can't remember if I've said it here. But we were talking about what the Christian life is. You keep hammering me. Why do you do this? And why do you do that? You follow all these crazy rules. And it occurred to me at one point why she was saying this. I said, wait. Dr. Withington, let me explain this. Here's the key fact of Christianity. God defines me. I don't get to. That she could not handle that. Because if anything about this culture says is, no one can tell me who I am. And God says, no, I will tell you who you are. You may think you're not cut out to be married anymore. You may think you're not cut out to be a good student or a good worker. I don't care what you think about yourself. I'll tell you who you're meant to be. A friend of mine went to graduate school, and I fully feel this. I mean, as a married man and two kids, trying to finish my doctorate is a near impossible task. And I get like 20 minutes, and I just get into the book I'm reading, and I just get excited about my topic, and Megan cries, or Emily needs fed, or Tara's got to go to work. It's always something. And my friend, who's in the same situation, got three kids, did his PhD a couple states away, you know, on weekends, and decided he now knew who he really was. He now knew who he really was a literature scholar. That whole married thing, that wasn't him. It's not me. It's not me. I understand it's a good thing. It's just not who I am. I'm sorry. And he called my brother and said, I think I'm going to stay away for a while and figure this out. And it struck me that that's the root of all sin. That's what Adam and Eve were promised in the garden by the devil. You don't have to be who God says you can be, one who doesn't know good and evil. You can be who you want to be. I said to Ann Withington, the point of Christianity is God tells me who I am. I don't get to do that. I may think I'm a great history scholar, but I'm not going to be. Right now I'm going to be a husband, and I'm going to be a father, and I'm going to teach at a teaching college. Not at a research college, at a teaching college. And this is what God has called us to. And so each of these things, God is trying to redefine us, trying to say, by the soundness of his doctrine, who we really are. Who we are for our own benefit. Who we are to live a sound and full, complete, joyous life. Are we catching the beauty? It's not a matter of rigor. It's not a matter of laws that keep us down and make life difficult. God's trying to tell us who we are at our fullest. My friend of mine didn't realize if he were to be a father and a husband, even though it's difficult, he'd find the fullness in life. It's not meant to sap that out. It's meant to be sound in its completeness. The law is a good thing. It brings life. God defines us and tells us who we are. In each of these stages, we own up to different responsibilities in doing this. And in doing these, we find life. We find the soundness of God's doctrine. And so the second thing we have here is Paul laying out very detailed and very clearly, succinctly, exactly what the soundness of this doctrine is, exactly how this is supposed to influence our lives. This is not some heady theology. This doctrine has got feet, it's got legs, it's got eyes, it's got a pulse. This is real doctrine, how you live your life. And this is important to Paul, a number of reasons, theologically as we'll see, but it's important to Paul from where he's preaching this. It's important because doctrine is not just the way you think, it's the reputation you have. See, if you have good doctrine, then you live well. You live honorably to God. And notice there are a couple places in here where Paul says this over and over again. Look at verse 5 when he's talking about young women. Be sensible, pure workers at home, kind, being subject to your own husbands. Why? Here's the key word, that the word of God may not be dishonored. God's reputation is in the balance. Not only your reputation, but God's reputation is in the balance. Verse 8, sound in speech, beyond reproach, in order that the opponent may be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us. Our reputation is important because our reputation is God's reputation. It's important that our doctrine not just be heady, but be the way we live, because that's the doctrine people see. You've heard the hokey saying that you might be the only Jesus someone else sees. That's true. You are a bearer of the image of God. And so when people see you, they see God. How do you bear his reputation? When you're done living, do they say, wow, that God guy is pretty cool. That guy God really shows love and shows responsibility. That God woman really understands what it's to be a kind, selfless person. Because what they say about us, they're saying about our God. Think about when Nathan comes to David after the death of Uriah. This is an astounding little phrase, and it's really unnerving because he goes to David and gets him to see his sin, and then he says to David, you allowed the enemies of God to blaspheme. But he never talked about Uriah. He didn't say, you killed Uriah, and you took everything away from him. Yeah, you did, but that's secondary. Here's the first thing you did, of primary importance. You allowed the enemies of God to blaspheme. You hurt God's reputation. Cretans had built up one reputation. And Paul is dynamically trying to get them to attach their lives to a greater reputation, the reputation of God's character. So when people walk away from us, they have a good memory of who God is, a reputation they can understand, something about God that they know. I think he goes a little bit further here for the title of the sermon, and the point that really grabbed me is in verse... it's right here. Verse 10. Regarding bondservants, and I think this appeals to everything else he said thus far. Not pilfering, but showing all good faith, that they may, and check the word here, adorn, that they may adorn the doctrine of God, our Savior, in every respect. That's an interesting word. What does it mean to adorn something? I couldn't think of a great analogy. I mean, there's a lot of analogies, I guess, and I don't want to get into women in clothing. So I'll stick, or men in clothing, which I even know less about. I'll go to Christmas trees. That's an adorning, right? And it's fairly safe. Here's a Christmas tree. It's grown up beautiful. It's fit to proportion. But then we adorn it. and it bears something out of it. It brings some beauty out of the tree. When God is calling us to adorn His doctrine, God has given His law to do all. We read the law this morning. All these things are supposed to do. These ways are supposed to act, think, talk. All of these things in the previous verses. It's good those laws are there, but they're not complete and they're not beautiful. They're beautiful when we adorn them. When we adorn them and live them out. See, God's law was not meant to be spoken. It was meant to be lived. It was meant to be incorporated. It was meant to be absorbed. And catch this, God's law is not complete until we live it out. God could have sat in the eternity of His being and just given laws. But His law only means something because we're there to keep it. Because keeping it is the purpose of the law. It's not only our purpose is to keep the law's purpose is that we should keep it. That's what makes the law beautiful. In Matthew chapter 5, when Christ is laying out the law and the Beatitudes in a very difficult way, Christ says, "Don't think I came to abolish the law and the prophets. I came to fulfill them." Fulfill them? Fulfill the prophets? What do you mean fulfill the law? The law needs fulfilling? Yes. The law needs to be lived. God is yearning for worshipers to live out His law. It's an incomplete reality until you live it out, until we live it out. And that's the beauty of God's great doctrine, is that it's lived. It's part of joyous, Christian, victorious life over sin, over pain, and over suffering. It's turning the curse around, is living the law. Returning to the Garden of Eden, one small step at a time in our lives, but keeping the law and obeying His precepts. We get to make the law of God beautiful. That's the way we need to think about the law. We have to stop thinking about it as ugly. It's the way we sell it too, by the way. We go out into the world, we sell God with a very ugly finger, wagging it everywhere. I do it too, looking down our noses at sinners. We don't bind up broken hearts more often than we wag fingers to break them. Tends to be the Christian way for some reason. God is not calling us to pound doctrine. He's calling us to adorn sound doctrine. To live it out in our lives and make it beautiful. To make the law beautiful, to make salvation beautiful, to make God beautiful. To establish His reputation in our culture, Crete. A world of ugliness, of sin, of selfishness, and brokenness. This is a great task. It's much more lively, I think, than the typical approach. At least it has been in my life. Very legalistic, very boring, very dusty. God is calling us to adorn His great doctrine. Unfortunately, talking about the character of God and talking about His reputation is a difficult, overbearing task. And it's right about this point, if we're reading this through, it would be difficult. I think at this point we'd be overwhelmed by helplessness, by the size of the task in front of us. But then Paul eases up and sets the broader context in verse 11. Why do we do this? Why are we called to take on this tremendous task? Why are we called to live this way? Because... Verse 11, the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. This is not salvific. Christ has saved us. The work of grace has been accomplished. We don't keep the law as if to attain it. We keep the law because that's what's right and that's what's good and that's what's pure, that's what's beautiful. Paul says, think on all these things because they're beautiful. Think on all beautiful things. That's part of who God is. That's why we keep it. For the grace of God has already appeared. Salvation has already come to all men. That's been accomplished. Think of the law differently now. Think of it as adorning. Think of it as beautiful. Think of it as sound. For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation to all men. And not only does Paul set the stage inside the broader context of God's grace, which is our only power, but then he gives us three things, and I'll just do this quickly, three things to help in this activity. Verse 12, instructed. Christ's coming is an instruction. It's not just a moment in history where we're saved. We can return to it every day. Imagine having, I hate this phrase, but I can't think of a better one. Imagine having the owner's manual. Imagine having it right in front of you. You can look up when you have a problem. Error code. 303256. Error code. There it is. Rather than dancing around it like I do with my computer and get nowhere, we've got an instruction manual. His salvation, Christ's coming has instructed us. You don't have to go out there alone and figure out how to do this. His instructions are clear. They're written in black ink on white paper. So number one, he's given us very clear instructions that help us deny ungodliness and worldly desires, help us to live sensibly, verse 12, righteously and godly. But more than an instruction manual, he's also given us a hope. Imagine having a hope that you'd be able to fix your computer. I don't have that. My friend called me. I called him one day, and I threw a problem. I said, Glenn, what do I do? He's a computer tech. He said, Dan, there's one way to always solve a computer. Keep a 5-pound mallet with you. And if something goes wrong, just smash it. Because at the end of the day, you win, and the computer loses. It's a moral victory. I'm going to help you finish your paper, but it's a moral victory. Well, we don't have to smash the computer of our lives, our inner man that's broken, because we have a hope that one day this will end. It's a promise that's held out there. And we're told to see this hope and visualize it. Don't just put it out there like someday. Someday I'll write my dissertation. Yeah, whatever. That's like out there with no substance whatsoever. And I say I'll do it someday. Someday it'll be complete. That means nothing. This kind of hope is something you're supposed to materialize in your mind. You're supposed to dwell on it. You're supposed to meditate on it. It's encouraging. It's supposed to uplift you. It's supposed to give you the promise that one day all this striving will be over and the true, sound, beautiful life will have arrived. And so we're supposed to look forward, verse 13, to the blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God. And verse 14, even better than this, we get to look back. It's one thing to have an instruction manual, but imagine having someone that's completed it. Imagine having someone that's lived it out. You can prove they've done it. I just met a guy a couple days ago at my college who's an adjunct who defended his dissertation in May. And he walked in like a beam of hope for me because he did it. He actually went through it. He defended it successfully. He's actually a doctor now. Not only do we look forward to the blessed hope, but we look back to a historical moment when God lived all of this out perfectly in Christ, giving himself for us, that he might redeem us from every lawless deed and purify himself for people for his own possession. And so God instructs us, gives us a hope, and gives us history. In verse 15, to end this way, let no one disregard you. Let me say this in closing. Our reputation does matter. And we don't care whether people like us or not. Christ promised the world will hate us. That we get. But does the world not trust us? When people meet us and they walk away, they go, yeah, that guy, you never know with Christians. Those Christians are always out for themselves. They're always looking to put you down, to lift themselves up, to make themselves look more holier than you. They're always willing to show you what you don't know about God and what he knows or she knows. Our reputation matters. Because like in Crete, we're trying to build a church. We're trying to bring God to this earth. We're trying to bring God to this community where we are. And we have his reputation to mind. And so when we walk away from people, how do people know us? Well, that person's really trustworthy. You know what? When I talk to a Christian, is that person, that mechanic, a Christian? Yeah, you'll be fine. I mean, it's going to cost money, but don't worry. They'll treat you okay. Is that how we bear ourselves? Is that the reputation we have? And there's more at stake here. Not only our own joy in life, because that's true. The more you follow God's law, the happier your life is. I just know that's true. I've talked to enough older people to know that's true. But on the other end, because we bear God's reputation in the doing of it. And so we're called to live out this sound doctrine. On the confidence that we've been saved, looking forward to the hope that is in Christ coming and back on his redemption. These things speak, exhort, and reprove with all authority, and let no one disregard you. You are God's people. Praise be to God.